Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, I sit down with best-selling author Louise Penny to discuss her new mystery novel, Kingdom of the Blind, as well as her other books in the Inspector Gamache series, her writing process, and an anecdote or two about how she began her career as a writer. Louise lives in a small village south of Montreal. In 2017, she received the Order of Canada for her contributions to Canadian culture. This program was recorded last month before a live audience at Sandwich High School.
Hi. Everybody feeling pretty good? This is great. I'm so excited to be here with you, Louise. And I know probably many in the audience know this, but if you don't, you were a radio host and journalist
before. Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am talking to you.
And so I was just enjoying all these people.
I know. It's exciting. So I want to, this career, you know, CBC, you're this radio host and journalist, and you decide to become a mystery writer. What, tell us about that
well,
decision.
Well, it seemed a natural progression to go from public radio into murder. I had lots of time to scheme. Well, I'd wanted to write. First of all, I want to thank you so much, Mindy, for coming, for doing this, and I want to thank Titcoms for you guys. You're so lucky with that bookstore, isn't it? Fantastic. So thank you. And what? This is the best set ever. This is fantastic. And there's I see Armand
yes,
has been.
Yes.
There is in his boots. I'd wanted to write since I was a child. I can tell you exactly when. I was 8 years of age. It was a Tuesday. No. I know you're all thinking, oh God, she's 60 years of age and she's going back to when she's eight. That's 52 years. Oh, blow through. Fortunately for you, it's riveting. So I was just a really fearful child. I don't know why. Thankfully, I was never given a reason to be afraid. But I was afraid of everything. Other children, hugely afraid of other children. I was afraid of the night. I was afraid of the daytime. I was afraid of just every. My cardinal fear, I think, was spiders, which was verging on a phobia. And my favorite place to be, and still is, the only place where I sort of felt safe and sovereign was alone in my bedroom reading. And it's still my favorite place. And I can see you nodding because it's probably your favorite place too, or many of you. It got so bad where when I was bad as a child, which wasn't really very often, but as punishment, my mother would send me outside to play. So I was sitting on the side of the bed. And this moment changed my life, and I can see the rosebud wallpaper, and I can feel the nubbly chenille bedspread underneath my hand as I'm reading Charlotte's Web. Now, it's possible I was a slightly slow child because I was about halfway through Charlotte's Web before I realized that Charlotte was a spider. Now, to be fair to my eight-year-old self, I think I knew. My God, I hope I knew that Charlotte was a spider by then. But what happened then, as I said, it's changed my life. And what happened was I realized that I loved Charlotte. And I didn't want anything bad to happen to her. And in that instant, my cardinal fear, the thing I was most afraid of, was cured. It was gone. And for a child whose entire day, his entire week, year, is prescribed by the least fearful thing to do, to have the most fearful thing cured was magic. And I understood that magic was contained in the book, in the story, in the power of words to heal. And I wanted that. I wanted that power. And from that instant, I knew I would be a lifelong reader. But I also thought, if it's that powerful to read, how healing must it be to write? And so I knew at that instant that that's what I was going to be. Now, the thing is that because I was fearful, my fear of spiders was immediately lifted to be immediately replaced by a fear of writing. So what I did, this is a long But well worth a journey to get to the answer of your question. What I did was, when I had time, when I finally grew up and could take make these life choices, instead of going into creative writing, as any normal person would do who felt that they were put on this earth to write, I went into journalism and took this ancillary route around. And it actually ended up being the very best thing, because I got to listen to people. You're clearly a great listener, unless you've fallen asleep.
But, you know, when you think about writing for radio and TV, very, very different than the writing that you do now. So what did you take away from your experience as a journalist to your writing now? I mean, because forget adverbs. You know.
Okay. No. Exactly.
Adjectives.
When was the last time?
I mean, adjectives. I'm sorry. Yeah.
When was the last time you used an adjective?
Yeah.
On air.
Right. You don't very
you
much.
Don't.
Yeah. I do a little bit because mine's a little more conversational. But in the news, you know, you don't.
No. Exactly. Yeah. If a story is 5 lines long, it's done.
That's it. Yeah.
So I was pretty
very
sure.
Very concise.
My first book would be like a page and a half, and that would be, you know, having flushing it out. So that wasn't helpful. There were a number of things that were very helpful. One was, as I mentioned, you get to a really good journalist, clearly you, is a great listener. They don't do a lot of talking. They draw out the guests. And so you become a very, very keen listener. You pick up on emotions, you pick up on nuances, body language, all those sorts of things. And I think a really good writer is generally a good listener as well. You also pick up on things that I didn't really even know I was picking up on, but how people talk, so that dialogue became a little bit easier to do. But the things that are sort of the softer skills, again, that I didn't realize I was learning as the 20-year career went along, one was discipline, one was focus, being extremely focused. Another was editing, which I think can really scare a lot of, particularly first-time writers, is that you feel that you've done your first draft and therefore it must be perfect and doesn't need editing. But as a journalist, and a radio journalist who did a lot of documentaries, you know, editing is your friend. You have
to edit all the time, yeah.
That's right, and you become quite clear at what the story is, at deciding there are 3 or 4 stories out there, but one is the main, one is the taproot, and which one is that? And that's the one. The others can be like harmonics, but the main story has to be clear. And that helps me a lot, because I do 3 or 4, sometimes 5 drafts of my stories, and each edit is fine-tuning and fine-tuning and fine-tuning until I can't think of anything more to do. And at that stage, I hand it over to my professional editor at my publisher. But that skill was learned in 20 years of journalism.
So you decide you're going to be a writer, and you think, historical fiction, that's where I'm going to start, right? I'm going to write historical fiction.
And not just historical fiction, I'm going to write the best book ever written.
Yeah. So how did you go from this idea of historical fiction to creating Chief Inspector Armand Gamache?
Well, what happened was, again, fear, right? So Michael, my husband, God bless him, said, I had been covering a lot of Quebec politics, and Quebec had been, I know you're because we're so close to Quebec here, I'm sure you're familiar with the history of the sovereignty movement, the separatists, and the referendums, and we had a referendum in the late 90s, and it was so close. It was so bruising. It was so shattering that nobody came away feeling a winner. As it turns out, the no side, in terms of no, don't separate, won. But the margin was so close. It shattered families. It shattered friendships. It was a terrible situation. And I came away from that just exhausted. I didn't want to talk Quebec politics anymore. I didn't want to hear about it. I am sensible to the fact that right now I'm sitting in front of 1,000 Americans saying that I was shattered by Canadian politics. But I came home one day and Michael, God bless him, said, if you want to quit work in order to write that book you've always been talking about ad nauseum. He didn't actually say ad nauseum, but that was implied. And he said the most wonderful thing, almost up there with when he first said, I love you. Nothing will ever be as great as that. But what he said was, I will support you. Isn't that beautiful?
It is, yeah.
Because when, you know, when someone says, I love you, and again, there's nothing in the world like that, there is no real act implied or contract implied, at least not by the woman, sometimes by the man. But when someone says, I will support you, then there is. There's an understanding there. And thank God he meant financially. And he did. So I quit work. Announced all over CBC Radio I was quitting to write a book, this historical fiction, the best book ever, and then suffered 5 years of writer's block. 5 years. Two would have been enough. Five, I'm an overachiever.
So the inspector is inspired by your late husband, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So. Yeah, very much so. Michael is an extraordinary man. He was the chief of hematology at the Montreal Children's Hospital. He was essentially the doctor you never want to have to see because it meant that your child was desperately ill. He had this is the worst job in the world, and he just the kindest man. And the first time, the first Christmas we were together, we were at a Christmas party at the Children's Hospital, and there were the children playing and Santa and whatnot, and the parents were around, and I'm chatting with some parents and seeing with the kids playing, and I looked across the room, and there was Michael looking at them. And then very slowly he turned so that he was facing the wall, which is not something you see very often. So I went around, and he was crying. And I said, Michael, what's... And he said, he alone in that room knows which child will see another Christmas. Mm. And if I didn't love him before that, I loved him at that instant. Mm. Michael learned from those children what a gift life is and what a betrayal it is of those kids who don't ever grow up to get gray in their hair. Mm. If those of us who do don't live life to the fullest. Mm. Don't live it with joy, with gratitude, with awareness, with decency, with kindliness, with courage. And Michael lived it with all those things. He was the happiest man in every room, not because what was happening to those kids made him happy. It didn't. It was devastating. But he loved life because he felt it was his contract with those children. And that's what I try to imbue Gamache with, that he is a happy man, not because he's a little bit too insensible or stupid to realize how cruel the world is. Of course he does. He knows exactly how cruel the world is. He chooses to be kind because he loves life and he understands how precious life is. It's the yin and the yang. It's the light and the dark. That's what the books are about, the duality of life and death, of the beautiful village and the violation of the terrible crime. The gap between what the characters are saying and what they're actually feeling. So it's about all that duality.
Yeah. So your first book, Still Life, you sort of rejected, I guess, for a while. People would say, hey, I want to make a movie. And you were like, yeah, no. And you finally said, yeah.
I did.
What happened?
How clever was that? did anyone here see it?
Oh, yay. Okay.
Oh, really? Twice.
How many read it? How many read the book, Still Life? Ah, see, a lot more people read the book.
Right.
Okay.
Now, how many here liked the movie?
Oh, a couple.
The Twice Woman.
Somebody over there, yeah.
Well, I'm glad. I'm happy. I'm happy about that. And I try not to criticize the movie too much because I understand that as a writer, you're never going to be, it's never going to be able to capture everything that I feel it should capture because the book is genius. No, it just can't. I know. I understand that. And a movie has to be, you have to hand it over to the filmmakers.
And they take political license, yeah.
And a movie isn't a book.
Yeah.
And I also don't want to criticize it because I don't want the actors to feel like I'm criticizing them. But I think, it was disappointing. You know, these characters, without being too precious about it, have given me a life beyond anything I ever dreamed. And I can dream pretty big. Michael used to call me a horizontalist because I would spend most of the day trying to get horizontal, either on the bed or in the bathtub or on the sofa. And he used to have to listen to me. This was before I'd even finished writing Still Life. I'd be in the bubble bath practicing my Oprah interview. Oh, good question, Oprah. Oh, yes, no, that's insightful. And we'd become best friends.
Of course.
Of course, and then I would have to unfriend her because she's very clingy. Poor Michael, he's like in the next room listening to this babbling on. So I dream big. I had 40-some years to dream about what it would be like to be an author, and I never dreamed this big. I never dreamed I would walk out on the stage here in Sandwich and see this number of people and have such a great time. So, I mean, I'm very aware of how lucky I am, because there are a lot of authors who write better than I do, who work harder than I do, and who haven't enjoyed the success. So it would be churlish of me not to embrace this gift of the success that I've been given. But the characters, they've contributed to this success, and I feel that I owe them protection. Mm. I owe them books that are worthy of them, as I owe you. I mean, you're spending time, many of you are spending money, lots of money, I hope, on the books. So, you know, I did not do a very good job in that first movie of protecting the characters. So now I'm very careful about giving permission, and I've turned down every subsequent. Mm. Well, there's some, you know, that are more interesting than others. I'm not closing the door completely. Who here, would like to see an adaptation, let's say a PBS or Amazon or whatever?
Oh, look. Oh,
that would be good.
Okay.
Who here would rather not?
Oh, got a couple. Yeah, there's a few.
Yeah, quite a few. That's right.
Because it's never as good as the book, right? Never. Never as good as the book. You can't fit all that into a movie. So I was curious because a lot of authors say that. They have that kind of bittersweet feeling when somebody asks to make a movie out of their book because they know it's out of their hands. They're going to take, license and, change it.
For me, what could work, I'm great friends with Anne Cleves and her two series, Vera and Shetland. Brilliant writer, really nice woman too. But she's had a terrific experience, and so she and I talk about it, and that's encouraging. Mm. And the nice thing about a series, I think, if I can get my head around it, is that maybe the first few episodes, adaptations might feel a little superficial, but as you go along, of course, you learn more and more about the characters, and they deepen, and it becomes a familiarity. So I don't know. I'm flummoxed.
And there's a lot of people who make the comparison to Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie's character, that this, Inspector Gamache could be the next Hercule Poirot.
Do you know, to be honest with you, I don't really like that comparison.
No?
No. Well, I love Poirot, but he's, Poirot never changed. Mm. You read The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, fabulous book. Every book in between, and then the final book in the 1970s, I think it was, he was essentially the same man. A little bit caricaturish. Gamache has a really rich interior life. He's not at all like Poirot. I mean, I like the fact that people think he could be as successful and as well-known internationally. I like that. But I think that's where I'm hoping the comparison stops.
You're listening to an interview with best-selling author Louise Penny, recorded last month at Sandwich High School. We'll have more after a break. Welcome back to The Point. You're listening to an interview with best-selling author Louise Penny, recorded last month at Sandwich High School.
You read Still Life, and then you decide, did you decide at that point that you were going to continue this as a series, or when you wrote Still Life, did you know that you were going to write this series of books about Inspector Gamache?
You didn't. I knew I wanted it to be a series.
You did.
Because I love reading series books. So my thought was the first four books needed to be set in very clearly in different seasons, very clearly in Canada, very clearly not only in Canada, but in Quebec, and at different seasons. So the first one, Still Life, was autumn and winter and so on. But I also knew how difficult it was to get published. Mm-hmm. So I did not have an expectation that Still Life would ever be published. I wanted it to be, obviously. So I went into Still Life. Every decision I made was selfish because I knew it would take me a couple of years to write it, And if it's not published, then the writing of it is the only reward I'm going to get. So I am going to have to love writing it. And so I created a village I would live in. The first thing I created in the village was the bookstore, which Ruth seems to think is a library, but it's a bookstore. And then the bistro and so on. Have you noticed that there are no vegetables in Three Pines? And nobody gains weight or dies of a heart attack or a stroke or anything. It's a miracle. We should all move to Three Pines. And then I peopled it with characters I would choose as friends because I thought I'm going to be hanging around them for 2 years. They're going to be in my head. They're going to be my company for years. And as it turns out, they were for a couple of years as I was writing it. And then the main character, and, you know, I'd heard about that Agatha Christie had grown weary of Poirot. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know if it's true or not, but I think one of the reasons was that he didn't change.
Right.
I don't think you can blame Poirot for that, frankly. So I needed to create a man who, first of all, I would marry, whose company I would choose to be in, and who had a rich interior life and a complex history that we don't necessarily know at the beginning, but we get to know him.
So talk about some of the other characters and character development. Lots of times writers, they're writing a book and somebody is sort of a minor character and they go, but they just wouldn't stop talking. I had to make them a major character.
Isn't that annoying when they say that?
They're just like, they got to be more in the story. So talk a little bit about the character development and which characters those were for you that said, nope, I need to be more of a character in your stories.
Well, to be honest with you, before I actually even started writing, I think, my initial idea was that Peter and Clara, the artist couple, would be the major characters. Because I love the Thin Man, and I thought, well, maybe I can do a modernized version of Nick and Nora and have it these two characters. But then the more I thought about it, the more it just seemed a little bit cutesy. It seems to be sort of trying to force something. It was also derivative, obviously. But still, as I started writing the initial draft of Still Life, which was like this big, too. Do you know what happened? This is a sidebar, and then try to remind me because I'll forget what the question was. I tried to find out. It's probably easier now because there's Google and stuff, but this was before Google. This was in 2001 or two. I didn't know how long a book should be. So how long do you write? How long should a book be? So I looked at my books, and they're all about 300, 350 pages. So I thought, perfect. It needs to be 350 pages. So I wrote 350 pages, single-spaced. Turns out that was like twice as long as the book should be. That I think it was something like, oh, God, I don't know, 250,000 words. And it should be 90,000 words. So that's where the editing came in handy. What I did want to say is that in the first draft, this bulbous affair, Gamache didn't show up until, I think, the third or fourth chapter. It was all setting up Peter and Clara and whatnot. And that was an example where Nickel knocks on the door and there's Gamache. And there's Gamache having this conversation with Reine Marie, I think about a baptism or something. And it was just such a fun relationship. And he just seemed like someone who you think he can anchor the story. He can be the center that will hold, much more so than the artist couple. So then he very quickly became the main character. And Nickel, who was going to be the mentee, the apprentice, who he would then have a chance to explain his process to her. And that was her only role at first. But then we began to see what her interior thoughts were, which again, there was that gap between what she was saying to him, which was all very nice, and what she was actually thinking inside. And so she became a lot more complex and more interesting and ended up coming back in a number of books.
Are the characters based on people you know, or are they strictly from your imagination?
Well, there's the answer my lawyer would like.
Imagination.
Most of them are actually based on real people. Mm-hmm. I think many of them have some quality of me in them. But Myrna Landers, for instance, who's the bookstore owner and the former psychologist. She is loosely inspired by a very good friend of ours named Myrna Lashley. Nobody could ever make that connection. So cleverly hidden. Who's a retired psychologist.
Oh my goodness.
So yes, they're all, there are elements, particularly at first. I think the first draft of Still Life, they were more clearly the real people. And then they had to evolve their own way. So now they're less recognizable.
And that was a question I was thinking about, is how the characters have changed through the books. Because you mentioned that Hercule Poirot is the same character.
Right.
So is that something that's just sort of gradually happened as you're doing the stories? Is it conscious? You know, how have they changed?
Well, they've all, I'm hoping, evolved and grown. What I like, again, about the series, and you know, I think of these books as essentially one long book that starts with the first line of Still Life and ends at whatever the final sentence is of the current book. So they're so intertwined at this stage. The growth of the characters, I was not planned out at the beginning. I knew I wanted them to evolve, so I created characters who I felt could evolve and who clearly, I think that's one of the joys too of writing about a lot of middle-aged people. Most of them, Gabrielle and Olivier, were sort of in their 30s, but the rest were in their 40s and 50s. So they clearly have a history, but we're not seeing the history necessarily. So that was part of the joy, was as the series went on, we not only get to see how the current issues reverberate for them as the series went forward, but we also get to see more of the history and why they are the way they are. And Jean-Guy, for instance, in the first book, is very different from the Jean-Guy. I mean, he's recognizable, obviously. You don't want him to be, you know, suddenly he's, you know, a Nordic god. He's recognizable as the same man, but wouldn't it be awful if 15 years, he never, and especially given what's happened to him in the books, that he didn't learn something.
What about the research? What kind of research do you have to do? Obviously, I'm assuming you don't know much about being a chief inspector.
A male francophone chief inspector.
Yeah. So what kind of research did you have to do? And you've been writing these books for a while now. Is the research still as intense as it was in the beginning?
I think, again, as a journalist, it helped that I had covered a number of police issues. To be honest with you, my desire was not to do a documentary. It was to create a world, my own world, with my own reality, where the Sûreté du Québec behaved in the way that I needed it to behave. Gamache behaved in the way I needed him to behave. To be honest, I have no idea if that's how a real murder investigation is ever conducted. I don't care.
It is in your world.
No, it works for him.
Yeah. And works for you, right?
I have no interest in forensics. Mm-hmm. I have no interest in describing an autopsy. I have no interest in blood spatters. I mean, we all assume they're there. I am a big believer in, and huge fan of Hitchcock, who knew that the closed door was always more terrifying than the open door. So I don't have to describe the body.
Mm.
I don't have to describe the blood smears. All I have to do is really describe people's reaction to what they're seeing and let you. I think reading is at least as creative as writing. So we're two halves of a whole. I suggest and you fill in. I steer, you paddle.
Mm.
And we get to where we need to be.
All right. How many have read the new book, Kingdom of the Blind? Okay, don't worry, I'm not going to spoil it for those of you who haven't. That would be terrible.
You won't mention the zombie invasion?
No, shh, don't say it. So, but one of the themes in this book has to do with the opioid crisis.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you had to do a little bit of research on that. We're hearing a lot about fentanyl now, and in the book, it's a little bit stronger drug, carfentanil, which I don't think a lot of people have heard of. So was... How did that come onto your radar screen?
And this is part of the research, was researching that. What's out there? There's one called Crocodile, which is a big thing coming out of Russia. Well, it's hard to get away from it, isn't it?
Mm.
This started, the opioid issue started in Glass Houses, the book before, and then has, again, this is what, I'm just so lucky, I just love these characters and being able to have things move forward and have you accept that, because I know that's, it's particularly for new readers, it can be a little baffling because things, I'm talking about things that started maybe three or four books mm-hmm. before. Though I do try to make each book self-standing, so I'd explain, I'm hoping enough to set the scene without ruining previous books. But it just seemed, again, it's that the duality of the lovely safe place of Three Pines, which clearly is not safe because nothing bad happens there. Very grateful that a lot of bad things happen there. Mm-hmm. It's safe because... Well, like any community. My community is safe not because bad things don't happen. It's safe because of the sense of community, of belonging, of friendship that we all feel, of forgiveness, of acceptance. That's what makes Three Pines safe. It's not that there's no violation. It's when there is a violation, people are there to help you through it.
And I told Louise before we came out here that generally when I'm interviewing a fiction author, I try not to read to the end of the book so that I can't ruin the ending. I couldn't. I had to read to the end of the book. So be prepared when you pick it up because you're not going to want to put it down.
But I did just want to finish with the opioid thing. To
oh, yeah,
say
go ahead.
This.
Yeah.
Thank you for
yeah.
asking
yeah.
about that because it's important to have that counterpoint to the quite lovely and pastoral Three Pines and then the counterpoint of the inner city, Montreal, which and it's just a dreadful thing that's happening yeah. now and it's just not only in the cities. That's what's terrible. It's happening in the countryside, in suburbs, mm-hmm. everywhere.
Yeah,
and it's a killer.
Well, the reason I asked about the research, I envisioned you doing all kinds of research because I found that those scenes that you write about and that drug culture in Montreal to be very, very real and authentic.
Thank you.
So you were spot on.
Thank you.
Just from the real reporting that is out there. There's one thing, a little section of the book that I wanted to mention because this is the relationship between Armand and his son-in-law, Jean-Guy. And he says Jean-Guy had been warning Gamache about the young cadets since she'd been admitted to the academy by Gamache himself. This was one great divide between them. This was the chief's weak spot, his soft spot. Gamache believed people could change. For the worse, yes, but also for the better. But Jean-Guy knew better. People did not, in his experience, fundamentally change. I thought that was a really interesting passage coming from a family of law enforcement people. I thought most of them would agree with Jean-Guy that they don't change. So you have this...
But you do a panel, right, with psychologists?
Yeah, I do.
And what would they say? Do they feel that when you do
know.
Your show
I,
with them?
I'll have to ask them that. And I think maybe it's because, you know, when you're law enforcement, it's just like when you're journalist sometime working a crime scene, you get a little jaded because
that's
what
true.
You see all the time. So I thought that was interesting. And I, again, kind of went to your point of that human side and things are sometimes, people are deeper than what they may seem. But I just thought that was a really interesting relationships set up
yes.
between the two of them, both being in law enforcement.
Yes, yes, exactly. And that our perception is based on our attitude. Our whole life is based on attitude. Is perception is driven by attitude, and our life is driven by our perception, and the different perceptions that Beauvoir and Gamache have of the same events.
Mm-hmm.
And in an earlier book, I describe Gamache believing that if you sift through evil, somewhere in there, you're going to find at least a nugget of good. Gamache believes that. Beauvoir believes if you sift through good deep enough, you're going to find evil. and he believes, I mean, that's an excellent passage to choose because I think he goes on to say, and it's one of the themes of the book, obviously, that is Gamache's blind spot.
Mm-hmm.
This belief in the ultimate goodness and desire to be decent of human beings. And Beauvoir is very afraid of what comes out of blind spots, the terrible things that come out of blind spots, and not only devour Gamache, but devour anyone standing close to him. Mm-hmm. And that's what this book is examining.
You're listening to an interview with bestselling author Louise Penny, recorded last month at Sandwich High School. We'll have more after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. Today we're bringing you an interview with bestselling author Louise Penny, recorded last month at Sandwich High School.
You mentioned that you try to make them standalone books, and so that people don't have to read from the first episode on. So do you keep notes? I mean, how do you keep remembering, okay, what happened in a previous, you know, like, that you don't, and I'm sure your readers would say, hey, wait a minute, didn't, did they correct you? Like, wait a minute. They're nodding.
You get something wrong?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, people tell you about it.
Why don't you talk about your writing process? Do you write every day?
Yes. I took a personality test in a doctor's office once. And it was what's your dominant personality? Are you patient? Are you kind? Generous? It turns out that mine is sloth. I mean, honest, who? I didn't even know that was one of the options. Everybody else gets to be patient and kind, and I'm... It did not surprise me at all. So, given that, I have to be very disciplined. And I think this is what we talked about before as a journalist. When you do a live show, you cannot be late for a live show. Not twice, anyway.
Yeah. So true.
So you learn discipline. If I'm not disciplined, nothing happens. And I think that was part of the problem with the beginning when I suffered from writer's block. I just expected that my free spirit would come and help me write the book. It turns out I have no free spirit. It is very tightly bound and likes it that way. So I write every day. I get up, Bishop the dog gets me up, but even if he didn't, I would get up at a certain hour. Write at the laptop. I set a word count. I'm very goal-oriented. It helps to know yourself, and there's no wrong answer, right? Some people aren't goal-oriented. Some people wait for the muse to move them, and that works perfectly for them. Not for me. So I set a word count of 1,000 words a day, and I know if I do that often enough, I will get to where I need to be.
I have a question right here. Come on, step right up to the microphone.
Just before you do, can we just make sure that there are no spoilers?
Yes, no spoilers.
No spoilers.
Yeah, okay, good.
First of all, your books focus on the drug epidemic, and how do you feel about having created hundreds of thousands of addicts to your books?
I my conscience is clear.
Just don't make her mad. Any other questions? You want to come up to the microphone and ask a question? While we're having somebody walk up, I read a great story about how you met your agent. I believe it was a tug of war over a scarf.
Oh, my God. Everybody turned down the book, right? Still Life? If I could have sent it into outer space, it would have been an intergalactic failure. Nobody wanted it. And one thing I kept hearing was no one would be interested in a mystery set in Canada. So what do you say to that? I mean, so's your mother. That was not a cogent argument. And so it got turned down everywhere. And then I was shortlisted for an award in Great Britain by the Crime Writers Association. Wonderful award for the best unpublished first novel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's spectacular. So I went, and this is where being a journalist helps. I did my research. Michael and I went to the... Because I knew that the award was really to be in the room with all these people I'd spent 2 years trying to get their attention. So I spoke to booksellers in London, said, who are the top three agents to represent crime fiction? And they gave them to me. So I went to the awards thing, and the first one was not at all interested in my book, set in Canada. The second one was drunk. And the third one wasn't there. And then I lost. And then 3 days later, I'm still in the fetal position, right? And Michael peels back the now crusty bed sheet and says, you know, you got to get up. You got to get up. We're going to go to this sale of goods, which is happens. I don't know if they do them here, but it happens around Christmas. You're invited to someone's private home. It's a cocktail party, and it's often a fundraiser. And they have out different goods, and you buy them, and it raises money for whatever. In this case, it was a women's co-op in Afghanistan. By then, Michael was going stir crazy, and I smelt, so I really had to do something. Hose me down, and off we went. But there was this beautiful blue pashmina. So I reached for it, and this claw reaches out at the same time. So now we've got two pretty anal Anglos playing a tug of war with this Pashmina. But of course, you know, we cannot admit that this is happening. So we just, oh yes, nice day, Moses. And finally she turns to me and she said, who are you? And I said, I'm Louise Penny. That should matter. And she said the most amazing thing. She said, I have your name on a post-it note on my computer. So I said, huh? Who are you? And she said, Teresa Criss. And that was the third name on the list. In all of London, in the entire world, there was one person I had to meet. And it was the only person I spoke to at that party. I let go.
I let go, yeah. Mm-hmm. Good move.
I believe I may have even bought it for her. And she's still my agent to this day.
That's funny.
No, but one quick thing is that I don't know about you, but for me, and maybe it's the Canadian in me, but whenever I hear someone speaking in a British accent, I hear an implied, you idiot. So it's been quite painful 14 years with Teresa.
All right, we have who's next? Come on up.
What makes you most happy about writing?
Oh, what a great question. Are you a writer? You want to be. How old are you?
I'm 8.
You're 8? My gosh. It's my little self. Oh, I love you. What makes me happiest about writing? Being able to create, being free to create a world that I have some control over, because the world can sometimes be a little scary. Yeah, I like that. I've chosen to write about people I love, and that's a rich experience. It's nice to be around them all day long. It's nice to be able to use my imagination. So that's what I like. What do you like most about writing?
Still trying to figure it out.
Yes, you'll have to
think
about
writing. That. Keep trying.
Yeah. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on up.
Thank you. That takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, for 8-year-old. Good going.
Beautiful.
Hi, thank you so much for the series. I just so look forward to each one. But I'm looking for some travel advice. Three Pines seems like, you know, Brigadoon. So where are some places, or where is it, or where is that atmosphere? Or what about the book tourism that's out there with the tours? So tell us about some of that, please.
Well, there are the books. I find it a little awkward when people like my publishers or reviewers or whatnot come up to where I live, which is in the Eastern Townships, and they realize, as soon as they arrive, they realize that I have no imagination. I am just writing what I see. And it is, the place that I live in, there is no Three Pines. It's not actually based on any existing village. It's really, in some ways, an amalgam of all sorts of little villages in the area, the Eastern Townships. Knowlton is the place that I live, Knowlton, Quebec, which is north of Vermont and just south of Montreal. But a lot of the little villages are similar in that they have the French and the English fact and in tone. A lot of people now are coming, of course, by the busloads, which is great. And there's a map you can get at the bookstore, Danny and Lucy's Broom Lake Books, which has the inspiration of where different places are, where the monastery is that inspired the beautiful mystery. Now, I do want to say that the monks were very clear, because this is a Benedictine monastery, where they sing Gregorian chants, and they've taken, if not a vow of silence, a strong suggestion of silence. But when it came time to research the books, the monks wanted to be very clear that this was not fact. No murders have happened. In fact, the abbey, after Michael and I stayed there to do the research, and just as we were leaving, I think he wanted to make sure we were, in fact, going. And because I said, you know, I want to do a murder mystery set in this monastery, and he said, oh no, you can't, you know, I'm sorry, that I can't allow that. Which initially was a bit of a blow, but then I managed to godlike resurrect an entire order of monks, the Gilbertines. But as he showed me to the door, he said, you know, a murder in a Benedictine monastery is just, you know, it's just unbelievable. It's simply not going to happen. Now the Trappists. I think that might be one of my favorite moments in this entire writing career. Threw an entire order under the bus. But people come up and there's actually now a tour, a local tour operator who will take you around, and there's a Bury Your Dead tour in Quebec City. Bury Your Dead in Quebec City, which is a little confusing, I think, for people who haven't read the books.
Thank you. And our final question.
I just have one quick question. You write about people who are French speakers, and you make the distinction between Francophones and Anglophiles. And I'm wondering if you speak French fluently, or do you know just the swears?
Merde.
I've been found out. It's an interesting little fact. I think it's evolving now as the cultures meld a little bit more, but the Francophones tend to swear with the exception of merde, using religious symbols. Hostie, tabernacle, sacré. The English tend to swear using bodily functions. I arrived in Quebec unilingual English. Well, I'd taken some French in school, but mostly unilingual English. I moved from Winnipeg to Quebec City, which is completely French. And because I knew, again, being slothful, that if I had any chance, if there was any back door, any crack I could squeeze through and not learn French, I would find it. So I had to put myself in a position where I had to learn French. But oh my God, it was brutal. I got in a taxi cab and asked to be taken to the war, please. He was so nice, he turned around and he said, "And which war exactly, madame?" I ordered flaming mice in a restaurant. And I called Quebecers good pumpkins, and it was just, oh my God. But did you know, the thing is that when you'd say something like that, people, they don't get angry. And partly because the Quebecois are very gracious people, but they don't get angry. They get very frightened. You can tell immediately you've said something wrong. Because hide the children. Can I just end, though? I did want to just briefly go back to something, sure, the question, sure, of where Three Pines is. Because the what I would like to say, and I actually talk about this a little bit in the afterword, that for me, Three Pines actually does exist. And it exists in a way that I find more meaningful than a physical place. And I think of it as a choice. I think of Three Pines almost as an allegory. It is when we choose to be kind instead of cruel. When we choose to, we see the flaws because they're so obvious, but instead of highlighting them, we choose to say something decent to someone else. When we are kind, and it takes so much more courage to be kind than it does to be nasty. When we make those choices, and I don't always make them, but when we do, when I do, I feel like I'm in Three Pines. And as a result, Three Pines, I can be in Three Pines right now. I can be anywhere in the world. And I think that's one of the strengths of the village of Three Pines, that it's a state of mind.
You are in Three Pines right now. Thank you for inviting me to share the stage with you today. Very
thank
enjoyable.
You, Mindy. Thank you to Titcoms. And thank you all so much. I've had so much fun.
Louise Penny has written 14 books in the Inspector Gamache mystery series. Her most recent, Kingdom of the Blind, is a number one New York Times bestseller. This program was recorded and edited by Brian Morris. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.